Did Britain's imperial fancies give us Brexit? That's the question we'll be discussing on the first ever Another Europe is Possible podcast with me, Zoe Williams from The Guardian, and Luke Cooper from Anglia Ruskin University. Today we're joined too by my ludicrously esteemed colleague Gary Young and also esteemed colleague Kerem Nisanjulu, who works on narratives of race, empire and Brexit at SOAS. Just to put it on the table, the point of this podcast, which will come out every fortnight, is to give an account from the left of why Brexit is such a disaster. Remain territory has been very much captured by that centrist axis personified by Nicky Morgan, Nick Clegg and David Miliband, and has become synonymous with a commitment to maintaining the status quo. Yet that doesn't begin to describe the values of those of us who were pro-Europe for progressive reasons. Not for its frictionless trade, though I can see we'll all miss it when it's gone, but for the rights it enshrined, the peace it kept, the cooperation it represented, and the ambition it sought to capture, pressingly but not exclusively, in relation to the environment. In our wilder moments, we see European institutions as more than a bulwark against fascism, as the network to connect the many left-wing movements that are burgeoning across the continent. Remain is, I believe, and I think Luke does, the natural position of the left, even the radical left, if we want to call ourselves that. Today we'll talk about imperialist fantasies and British exceptionalism. Was the case for Brexit essentially animated by golf club delusions about Britain's place in the world? And did that hubris make it inevitable that our leaving negotiations would play out in this shambolic way? I hope you enjoy it. You can tweet us if you like. Follow us on Twitter, at Another Europe. Right, so, Gary, this kind of is shaped around the column you wrote about the imperialist fantasies of the Brexiteers. And it was really fascinating listing all those leavers who had these massive colonial upbringings. How did you know that?
I was reading one of those Shipman books. Okay. And I just kept seeing these, you know, who grew up in Rhodesia, who was born, and I was like, crikey. And they just kept coming up. I wasn't even looking for it particularly, but after I'd seen the first couple, it felt like there was a pattern.
And do you feel like the kind of really peculiar worldview of these really posh Britons who grow up in Kenya and the way they seem to kind of understand national history almost 50 years behind people who actually live here, do you think that did inform their vision for Brexit? And do you think that's why it kind of bit us on the arse the way it did? Because we weren't expecting that.
I mean, I didn't, either in the piece or now, I didn't want to get too essentialist about it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, all sorts of people grow up in those places and they come out and they're brilliant or they're not. I think that Britain has never reckoned with its imperial past. And because it's imperial past, obviously there are all sorts of evidences of it here. Most of it took place somewhere else. You know, in America, I often say, well, look, you had your civil rights movement here on this soil. Britain had its civil rights movement in Kenya and Ghana and India and so on. And so Britain was never on this island necessarily touched by what it had done and what challenged it, which is why Gordon Brown can go around saying we have nothing to be ashamed of in the British Empire. It was a wonderful thing. Mm. Britain has never reckoned with the empire. And so that notion of what put the great in Great Britain, of kind of that we are in some way a bigger country in our imagination than we actually are in reality, that's what came to bite us on the arse. And the left has been as culpable, maybe not quite as culpable, but has been culpable in never really wanting to challenge that part of our myth.
I was struck recently thinking about the referendum in 75 and the decision to enter the EU in 73. The discussion was about trying to find, in some ways, a place for Britain in the world, which wasn't attached to empire.
And
that was a really big theme of the referendum in 75, to try to find that place.
Yeah, I mean, going back to 73, I think that's a really interesting moment and a really interesting conjuncture where there's a number of really different things coalescing at the same time, different but connected. So on top of the 1973 accession to the EC, just before that, you also have the 1971 Immigration Act, which introduces the principle of patriality into conceptions of British citizenship, which in really crude terms means if you're migrating to the UK from the former colonies or from the Commonwealth, it's fine if you're white, but if you're black or brown, it's considerably more restricted.
That's the bit that tripped up the Windrush people.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
I don't understand how that was enshrined in law. That must have been a difficult thing even in 1971 to enshrine that in law. What does it actually say?
Well, initially in the 1968 Commonwealth Act, which just preceded it, it was to do with having resided in Britain. And then in the 1971 Immigration Act, it was to do with being able to trace a lineage or family back to people who had resided in Britain. So if your grandparent or great-grandparent had lived in Britain, then...
So that is more or less explicitly saying...
Kith and kin, yeah. You know, you have the white Australia policy, and this is the white England policy. The Australians just called it that.
You could even argue that free movement has kind of been a norm for Britain in some ways, because it had a colonial free movement system, and then it had this very narrow gap before 1975, when then it entered a European free movement system.
But, I mean, there's more to it than just those acts as well, because 3 years before that, in 1968, you have Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, right? And that's a sort of like crystallisation of a particular moment in the history of British nationalism, where increasingly there's a reimagining of British nationalism in terms of people from former colonies being something external to Britain. Before, it was a multiracial empire, and then by this period, you've got a very sort of like clear crystallization of Britain as a white nation state. And the problem of race is something that comes from outside.
Would you say that wasn't the case before? So if you looked at 50s and early 60s Britain, would you say it did conceive of itself as a multicultural nation?
I don't think it did, but there was nonetheless, among certain sections of society in particular, I guess the ruling class, a conception of Britain as an empire. And I think the sort of like progressive narrowing or conception of what it means to be British is enacted from the 50s onwards, that sort of alongside the process of decolonisation, but also alongside the process of migration of peoples from Britain's colonies and former colonies.
I think it didn't understand itself as a multicultural nation, but it's understood itself as a multiracial empire.
Right.
And that it was the dominant civilising force in a world for the black and brown people. So my mum came in 1961. Her three A-levels were British Constitution, which I didn't even know we had, European History and English Literature. Those were the A-levels that she did. It was a grammar school system in Barbados. And she came on a British passport that I still have, or a Dominion passport or something like that. Yeah. But it's basically a British passport. And they paid for her to come. And the whole notion was, you know, that we are at the centre of a globalising, civilising influence, and you people are under our wing, really. Yeah. Which is why there can be, more recently, such a kind of weird paternalistic outrage at the treatment of the Windrush generation. These were our darkies.
We've moved straight in to talk about the immigration side, but I think there's also this great power side to it as well that's clearly for Jacob Rees-Mogg. There's this... I don't even know how important immigration is to them, really. I mean, they're prepared to use the race and immigration card, but I think really it's about a kind of colonial fantasy about Britain's place in the world.
And do you think, in a way, that having those colonial fantasies makes it a necessity that you're sort of anti-Europe? Because Europe always kind of forced the EU forced its members to make a humble and collaborative account of themselves. And they used to get really annoyed with us when we had these delusions of grandeur.
I don't think it's inevitable if you think of France or Portugal, or other places that have had empires. I mean, one of the distinctions that we have is you connect that empire thing to the fact that we weren't invaded, and then the use of Europe as a kind of tool of peace becomes, or the EU as a tool of peace becomes less... less urgent. So then the French, yes, they had an empire, but they just weren't as good at us, and nor were the Portuguese. And you know, that becomes the kind of the dominant view.
The French like us, but not as good.
And in your article, I liked when you had the two World Wars and one World Cup. is this like massive confession about weakness, really, isn't it, as a
yeah,
term?
This was the last time we were any good. I mean, there was a challenge that I had, apart from the racists who don't really count. The biggest challenge that I had to that piece was from Scots, who said, and I think they were wrong, this is not about Britain, this is about England. And they used that quote, which isn't a quote about England, as an example. And the reason I don't think it's about... the reason I don't think you can say that is because, first of all, Scotland was as involved in our imperial past. And it's not like Scotland sees itself as something other than having been part of an empire, even if it understands it in a different way. Then if you add on to that the fact that Wales voted to leave, that a lot of the dodgy money came through the north of Ireland, and that London, you know, I live in Hackney, that was more likely to vote Remain than Scotland, then I think that there are just too many variables to talk about it being England, and I wouldn't want to let the Scots off the hook. But there was that challenge of, are we talking about Britain here, or are we talking about England?
But in a strange way, Scottish nationalism has allowed Scotland, if you like, to move beyond.
Mm-hmm. It's allowed them to disavow everything that they hate about us, which is brilliant for them. And I mean, I think that's why their independence campaign kind of germinated a really kind of solid political identity, even though it didn't win.
But it also allows them, I lived in Scotland for 4 years, it allows them to disavow some of the uglier parts of their own history in which they were, very involved. So they're kind of travelling really light, you know.
Scottish history began in 2012.
Yeah.
The other thing, which I really liked about your piece, everybody's going to have to just read your piece now, but because the Leave campaign was fought on this kind of often unspoken hubristic grounds, the negotiations were bound to unfold like this. It was baked into their DNA that they'd say stupid, exceptionalist, you need us more than we need you things. And it was bound to unravel because they don't need us more than we need them. So do you feel like we're sort of locked in this? Do you feel there's any prospect of anybody...
I think it's like the speed with which we can come to terms with the actual size of our country rather than economy, the weight, the value of our country, as opposed to our image of it. So we leave with a perception that everybody is going to be in mourning, and Boris says whistle for your money, and then they say no, actually cough, and they do, and so they do go into it in the first 4 months or 6 months or maybe even longer, just like, well, obviously, you know, they are going to be falling over themselves. I mean, we're Britain. And it's taken a little while to understand, well, look, you had the empire, that was your power base, and then you set yourself up as the conduit between America and Europe.
Yeah.
Well, now you've left, and you got nothing. Britain's not an insignificant country. It's got a big economy. It's got culturally punches way above its weight. But it doesn't carry anything like the weight that it imagined that it did as a result of this kind of imperial nostalgia.
And going back to the point that you made about Britain never having a reckoning with its empire, I think that the other thing to add to that, never having a reckoning with the end of empire and in particular decolonization, and never actually confronting that historical process. And as a consequence, that imperial nostalgia can continue because they never actually confronted the fact that they got kicked out of all of these places, right? And the sort of power asymmetries that the empire was based on, the sort of power hierarchies that the empire was based on, don't exist in the same way in the world today. And that's something that's very rarely acknowledged or recognised or reckoned with among, I guess, Brexiters when they're invoking empire in their negotiations.
What do you think coming to terms would look like?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say, but if you think about, I don't know if comparable is the right word, but if you have other sorts of national reckonings with a problematic past, we have like truth and reconciliation, we have transitional justice and so on. And Britain has never had any of that.
No, that's true.
And
Truth and Reconciliation Commission on empire,
Yeah, that would put a cat among the pigeons.
Or even any kind of engagement with what it was. So you would argue with someone about, you know, about something that happened during the war, and you'll say, well, but, you know, there was empire. And I said, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then you sort of tell, actually, it was going on right through to the 70s. There was, you know, like, atrocities in America. And they're like, either, no, it didn't, and then you'd have to just get the books out, or, really? And so there's that thing of it not having touched the kind of core of our understanding of who we are. It's quite telling. When I lived in the States, on July 4th, Americans used to say, oh, this must be a very tricky day for you, you know. Like, dude, first of all, my folks are from Barbados. They really didn't have a kind of dog in that fight. But secondly, I say, look, every day is a day when somebody somewhere in the world is celebrating getting rid of the Brits. The Brits don't know that. Do you know what I mean? July 4th isn't some day that Britain kind of recognises as being anywhere relevant. You recognise that. So kind of every day somewhere someone is talking about their freedom in a kind of, you know, still in a nostalgic way. And Britain just goes blithely on, you know, each day as though nothing's happened.
And to bring it back to Brexit, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say there's another side to this Brexit coin. On the one hand, you have imperial nostalgia, but on the other hand, as I think you're alluding to, there's imperial amnesia as well, and a forgetting, complete forgetting that Britain ever had an empire and that it ever existed. And this is something that actually goes back to the period of empire itself. So there's this brilliant essay by Errol Lawrence, 1982 essay, called The Roots of Racism. And he digs out in that essay an unbelievable statistic from a survey conducted in 1951, where 59% of the British population could not name a single colony. And I think that sort of lack of awareness of precisely the existence of the British Empire is something that permeates to this day. And I think that also informs a very different set of discourses or slogans or ways of thinking about Brexit that is outside of Westminster and that is in the popular vote, right? So people who are supporting Brexit rarely, like, said, we want to re-establish the Commonwealth, we want to re-establish the empire. Instead, it was articulated in terms of, we want to take back control of the country.
Mm.
And I think this sort of, like, imperial amnesia informs that, right? The forgetting of an empire means that the way in which their support for Brexit was articulated was very different. It's not to say that empire was, in its absence, insignificant. It was still significant. It's just a different way in which the racism that was produced by empire was reproduced through imperial amnesia.
I mean, I think the kind of putting the great back into Great Britain, the kind of, you know, take back control. It's all about going backwards. It's very similar to make America great again. Like, it's, I mean, interesting forms of kind of quite aggressive nostalgia. And so the empire is never or rarely directly invoked, but it's always present. And that's actually one of the harder and more scary things, is that it's such a implied and dominant part of the narrative that you don't even have to say its name.
If there is a silver lining, I think it is the necessity of British society having to come to terms in a potentially quite traumatic way with no longer being the rule maker. So this sort of notion of the kind of glorious isolation comes from the 19th century, but it's totally there in Jacob Rees-Mogg's, you know, all of the language they talk, where, you know, the Churchill stuff with Europe, not in Europe, we're different. You know, fundamentally to it is, you know, we will be the rule makers, we won't be the rule takers. But then waking up to a reality where they're going to have to be rule takers.
This is really interesting, isn't it? Because all the take back control stuff is about going back to a time when we were more prosperous and more self-sufficient and we could control our own destiny because we weren't relying on anybody, and that was because we were prosperous. And it relates to that NEF research, when people's understanding of the economy, like even the kind of nuts and bolts of the economy, was so, so slight. But one thing everybody knew was that it was better in the past. And when you asked them when in the past, it was always the 50s, because they remembered something bad happened in the 70s, but the 50s were great. It relies on cultural amnesia, on the amnesia you talk about, Karen, because if you say we were rich because we were stealing a load of money from other countries, then nobody's going to replicate that. So you have to say you've forgotten the empire, or you have to actively forget in order to have this nostalgic fantasy. And yet at the same time, all their metaphors, in a way, are quite imperialistic. So they're having to kind of forget and remember simultaneously, which might be why they seem like they're having a nervous breakdown.
So, Gaminda Bamba is great on this. She's spoken about how this forgetting of the empire or lack of awareness about this imperial history ultimately leads to a confusion over who precisely we, in inverted commas, are as British people. Yeah. And so when you think about taking back control as a slogan, it's really, really involves an articulation or an expression of who belongs to be here, mm-hmm. who we are, who has the right to have access to jobs, mm-hmm. housing, welfare, and so on. So taking back control, although it rests on imperial amnesia, empire is like fundamentally present in articulating who we are as a country.
I'm glad you went first there, because what I'm going to say kind of leads really well off that, which is that there was this weird elision during the referendum between xenophobia and racism. So you had the issue of Europe and European immigration. Anxiety about that fundamentally rested around working class people from Eastern Europe, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and so on. Those were the people who... People weren't talking about wealthy French people and German people. It was those folks. But that bled very, very easily into... And we saw this after the referendum, into the grabbing of hijabs off people and just general racist attacks. And there wasn't ever any suggestion in the minds of the attackers that the women wearing hijabs were from Romania or Poland or had anything to do with Europe. And so there was this general xenophobic and racial enemy, and that we'd never had that conversation in a public way about that fundamental sit and down question of, like, we are here because you were there. Mm. And so because there had never been a really either honest or robust conversation about immigration, despite the fact that they would always say, we must have an honest conversation about immigration. It was always open and honest. That's what they would say. And it was never open. It was never honest. So there was no understanding of where non-white people had come from, what immigration was for. And then comes a lot of Eastern Europeans, and that becomes kind of intricately woven into the dysfunctional non-conversation we've been having before.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Of course, you go
straight from anti-Caribbean racism to Islamophobia to Poles and Romanians, many of whom are actually even more Islamophobic or more racist than the kind of than the Brits we're dealing with. And so we have this problem with the referendum, and now, I think, of trying to fatten the pig on market day, of trying to suddenly the issue of immigration becomes a problem for Blairites and for a certain kind of Tory who'd really been playing with the immigration kind of memes before and stoking up the racism and all that kind of stuff, and suddenly becomes a problem for them, but we never had the conversation. So of course they can run roughshod over it.
That's a good time to bring in the Labour Party and its relationship both to race, empire and immigration. My personal view is that they're all over the place, but am I wrong? What do you think?
Which part of the Labour Party are we talking
about? I mean,
there's three or four parties in a party.
Yeah, exactly. There are three or four parties. Everybody always talks about Blair as this kind of big, open-hearted, come on in, that my definition of a successful country is one that people want to come to. But actually, all the most unpleasant and punitive measures taken against asylum seekers were done by him. And I feel like he was the first politician who really weaponized one kind of foreigner to avert conversations generally about migration and freedom of movement. And it was a kind of savage calculation. If we can persuade people we're treating these people really, really badly, then they might not notice these 300,000 people over here. And I think exactly as you say, we haven't had this conversation and we're trying to fatten the conversation on the market day when we sell the conversation. I think it started with Blair. I don't think it started with Enoch Powell. I think Enoch Powell was quite straightforward and Blair was very sly.
I don't think it started with Blair. I think Labour's always, in the same way that it is balancing its metropolitan Brexit world and its Remain world, its Leave world and its Remain world, it's always preferred condemning and then indulging racism than embracing anti-racism and taking whatever hit there would be for that. I think what Blair did, particularly after 9/11 and then with the Iraq War and 7/7, was really drum home this kind of essential cultural notion of Britishness. I don't think anyone had done that before in quite the same way, of kind of who's in and who's out and kind of really rooting it in culture, citizenship tests. You know, I remember John Reed saying, we're British, we'll go where we want, we'll say what we want, we'll do what we want. He was being heckled by some people in the Muslim community over the war. It was horrible what he was saying. And the real worry when Labour does that is then where do those people go next? When the Tories are doing that, Labour will criticise racism and then indulge it. When Labour does that, then people just kind of, you know, fall off the edge.
But it connects to the economic programme as well for me, like for Blair, because he is different from other social democrats in Europe, which were always like, oh yeah, all of the neoliberalism stuff, look, we know that it's bad, but we just need to compromise, we just need to go along, let's shuffle along a bit. Blair was always distinctive because he believed his own propaganda, and it wasn't just on the neoliberal stuff. It was also on the project for a new American century, British nationalism, bring the Olympics to Britain, on that nationalism side as well. And for us now, fast forwards, anti-Brexit movement, the Blairites, it just renders completely inauthentic all of their, hey, we're cosmopolitan, we're internationalists, we're liberals, we must defend the open society, etc., etc., etc. Because you don't need to go very far. You know, Alan Johnson, leader of the Remain campaign. Sorry if you're listening, Alan. But, leader of the Labour Remain campaign, you know, find the videos of him, like, celebrating their online, you know, the retrenching immigration policy for non-EU migrants. You know, it's all there.
Where do we think Corbyn is on this, Kerem? Do you feel like he has a solid position on immigration?
No, he doesn't. And I think that's why Luke's question, what part of the Labour Party is an interesting one, because I think as someone who's very much on the outside looking in and doesn't really have a real sense of the internal dynamics of the Labour Party, the impression I get is that at the moment, the Labour Party's leadership's policy on these issues is shoulder shrug emoji. So in the sense that it's contested and there's different forces within the Labour Party who are trying to push for very different politics. So there might be some sort of, like, I guess, more pro-nationalist, even xenophobic entrenchment happening within the Labour Party. But I think also looking at, for example, Diane Abbott's speech that announced a campaign pledge to close Yarswood Detention Centre and a second one, I forget the name now. And also sort of going back on some of those really harmful Blairite policies towards asylum seekers and migrants more widely, suggest that there's other sort of tendencies within the Labour Party that might be pushing against that xenophobic entrenchment. And so it's contested is, I guess, the sort of cop-out.
I think a bit like Brexit, I fear that their view is, well, we're not carrying the ball at the moment, so let them just screw it up. I mean, people say this as though it's a small thing. I know it's not a small thing, but what I would like to see is Labour developing some kind of new narrative for this stuff. And I think if you look at the response to Windrush, every now and then there are these episodic flashes that show that there is a constituency for a different way of talking about it. And like this year is the 70th anniversary of both the NHS and the arrival of Windrush. I think that offers a great opportunity to talk about our most treasured institution and the fact that it could never have existed without immigrants. My mum came as a nurse. The NHS has always been sustained by immigrant labour. And that demands just talking about immigration and race in some other way than just sui generis, just as race and immigration, but as things people do, lives people have, communities they build. The reason that those Windrush stories took off eventually is because they're about people that you recognise doing things that you understood, not some abstract name going onto a plane, but dinner lady, school teacher, granny. These were things that people could relate to.
I have the same fears as you all do, which is that the Labour Party will never get itself together. Well, it's kind of seeing this as a carrier issue for how bad the Conservatives are. But my kind of more pressing fear, in a way, is that there is a sort of accepted narrative now that immigration drives down wages. And that is really, I'm not going to do a Jonathan Portes on your ass and say why it's economically wrong. It really worries me that that moves you away from what really determines wages, which is how much people pay. You know, it's like wages are this kind of, like the temperature, and they're kind of, they go up and down according to physical circumstance. And I'm really surprised at how easily, you know, the Corbyn leadership rolled on that.
It's impossible not to disentangle it with Brexit at the moment, immigration policy. My concern a bit is that they're attempting to disentangle it. Mm-hmm. So the best things that they say about immigration will be when, I think we'd probably all agree, you know, you'd like everyone to basically be treated the same, no matter where they came from. You want a universal policy.
Yeah.
So the best things that Diane Abbott says is, hey, we'd love to set up a universal policy that treated everyone the same. But then how do you attach that to the messiness of the reality of Brexit is almost impossible, because if you stayed in the EU or you stay close to the EU, then you can't have a universal policy. So on the one hand, they're staking out a place in the discourse, but that discourse is disconnected from other parts of what they're saying on a practical level. You know, there's no getting around the fact that Labour's manifesto in the last election, by saying we're going to end free movement, you know, that's the biggest retrenchment of immigration control since probably 1983 or the other, you know, some of the other dates.
I know, and I don't see why they can't connect the fact that if you're kind of, they think we're going to end free movement is a left-wing policy, because typical kind of classic Labour heartlands want to end free movement, or, you know, we're told they want to. And because those heartlands are Labour, then Labour must want to end free movement. But they haven't connected at all the fact that if you don't have free movement, you've just got free movement of capital. Mm. So you're basically, it's like a radically right-wing idea. Capital is allowed to move, stuff is allowed to move, rich people are allowed to move, nobody else is allowed to move. It's about as right-wing as you get.
And I don't even know that in many of those areas they are against free movement. I think what they are for is jobs.
What they want is jobs.
If they had jobs that paid and were worthwhile, and were just crappy, low-paid jobs, I don't think they would really care about free movement.
I think they want to be able to afford their rent, so that would help.
And it's all framing bias as well. How you ask the question almost entirely affects the answer you get. So nearly everyone will always say, including Leave voters, if you ask them, oh, do you want to continue to have the right to live and work and study in other European countries after Brexit? They'll say yes.
Majority
of Leave voters would say yes. And it's like, that is free movement. That is the principle. If you use the term free movement, no, never say yes.
But that comes back to that point that kind of, if we think of empire, there's always been free movement for rich people around the world is a given, right? If you're American or European or British, then you assume that there is nowhere in the world that you can't go. There might be places that are more dangerous than others, but the idea that anyone would stop you at the border and say, you can't come here, you'd just be like, well, why not? I've got my passport, I've got some cash.
Yeah.
Whereas it is understood that other people will not be able to do that. And it's not just understood, it's kind of extolled. And I think even weirder to me is that it is extolled on a quite naked class issue, that poor people aren't allowed to travel. Mm. Rich people from Saudi, in the national anxiety, rich people from anywhere should be able to travel.
It's exactly the same, though, as that kind of, how many kids are there with English as a second language? And English as a second language becoming the kind of shorthand for a shit school is full of kids with English.
Free school dinners.
But, you know, they don't mind when kids in Eton have English as a second language because their first language is Russian.
Yeah.
You know, it's a completely false signifier to mean the poor ones, not the rich ones. And it's very depressing. I find it really depressing. And the whole Lexit line, which is, you know, poor people don't want freedom of movement. A million young people don't have passports. So this idea that the young all want to remain is bullshit because, you know, all the ones without passports don't care about freedom of movement. There's a real kind of sourness to it. And I don't think it is a reflection of left-wing values at all.
Me and Zoe, we're probably fanatics, aren't we? We're fanatics on Remain. Are we fanatics?
We do spend a lot of time.
We are probably fanatic. Fanatically Remain. And I think neither of you are fanatic Remain, actually. And I just wanted to ask, you know, Gary said in that article, hey, I wasn't sure about before. And I just wanted to ask how you feel about Brexit now from the non-fanatic but against it perspective. Just be really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's, first of all, I think it's a bad idea. I mean, I always thought it was a bad idea. And I kind of, you know, you opt out of the European Union, you don't opt out of neoliberal globalisation. It was better be in it with some social democratic protections and out of it. I still feel that. Mostly I feel like there was this slow motion car crash that kind of, there's five people in the car, three voted to drive it off a cliff, two said no, and so then we're like, okay, let's go, we've decided to drive it off the cliff. And so we're heading off the cliff, and then the person who was driving is just like, I can't be arsed now. So now no one's even driving, do you know what I mean? I feel that kind of I can't remember if it was in that piece or another, and I said, you know, they're like the dog that chased the car but didn't expect to drive it. Do you know what I mean? Like they call it. That these people who made this argument, I think, not only, but I think the imperial stuff was kind of central to it, had no vision for what this thing would be beyond it would be great because we're great. And it's, all, and it's obviously not panning out the way that they thought, and it doesn't look like they've got an alternative vision. And that then does begin to really worry you, right? Because you're like, well, there seems to be a kind of almost sleepwalking into something that then becomes irreparable.
And so
that's what I think about it. And weirdly, I don't feel fanatical about that. I'm beginning to like see them, just think, oh God, whenever I say May and Brexit, so I just say, oh, for fuck's sake. You know, it's got to that level of just a wearied exasperation that I'm almost discounting the failure that will come. I'm not claiming that as a great position. I'm just describing my
state
of mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would agree with Gary on all those things. I think my sense of unease and my lack of, I guess, fanaticism stems from my hesitancy with the way in which the idea of Europe is often mobilised. Which, again, going back to empire and questions of empire, again involves some sort of amnesia over the European colonial past.
Yeah.
And I think that's particularly pertinent when you situate Europe in a colonial and post-colonial context, as a political entity that on the one hand is very keen to extract resources and wealth from the global south, but very against the movement of peoples from the global south into Europe, hence the construction of Fortress Europe.
Yeah.
That being said, for all the reasons that Gary set out, Remain strikes me as an obviously better political position to hold on to this. And so I'm sometimes hesitant to even articulate that argument about Europe's colonial history
in the sense
that it might feed into arguments around Brexit as well, which I'm really keen not to do.
But that's what's really angering, is that we've been forced into this situation where you can't even allow any ambivalence into a situation which is inherently ambivalent, because otherwise you're just playing into somebody's hand. And, you know, if I say I'm really uncomfortable with the way the EU has dealt with the migrant crisis, suddenly I'm Giles Fraser. And you're like, although I do like Giles.
If you're listening, Giles, we like you. You're just wrong.
We should end on some kind of resistance note.
I think there's hope in this.
If we look at the response to the Windrush crisis, there is a constituency that has never been really mobilised by the mainstream. So we don't know how big it is, we don't know how potent it is, but there is a constituency for a different story about Britain's past and its present and therefore its future. Now, we see flashes of it, and to me that's where the hope is, that people haven't challenged a lot of this stuff because they've never been asked to by mainstream political forces. But I happen to believe enough of them would get it if it was put to them in the right way. We clearly need another story, because this story doesn't work. It doesn't even work for the people who are propagating this story. And that gives us, on the left, an opportunity to start actually telling a different story.
Yeah.
Just to add on to that, because again, I completely agree, the way in which we might think about that story, because I think one of the reasons why the Labour leadership has been so dodgy on their understanding of migration is because existing criticisms of capital and capitalism, divisions between rich and poor and so on, in these criticisms, the question of race and racism has often been absent. And on the other hand, there is a really burgeoning social movement on social media, but also on the streets, against racism in this country that are often missing critiques of capital and capitalism. And so it often gets articulated in, I hesitate to use the term identity politics, but tends to take on that articulation. And so one thing that I would really like to see that I think we're lacking at the moment, but something we could work on, is bringing together those two criticisms of capitalism, of capital on the one hand, and racism on the other.
Yeah.
And I think going back to sort of where we started, a reckoning with Britain's imperial past as a distinctly capitalist and racist enterprise would be a good place to start.
And white working class people should be able to get on board with that, because it didn't do them any good either.
So, thank you both to our guests.
Yeah, thank you both guests.
Pleasure.
It's been brilliant. First ever podcast. Watch this space for more. And another Europe is possible.